Stand, please. This honorable court is again in session. Please be seated, please. Case number 12-1092, et al. American Trucking Association, Inc., petitioner, versus Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, et al. Ms. Jones for petitioner, American Trucking, et al. Mr. Nelson for petitioner, Public Citizen, et al. Mr. Lee for respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Erica Jones, and I represent the American Trucking Associations and the other industry petitioners this morning. The ATA and the other industry petitioners share the agency's articulated goal of identifying an hours of service regulatory regime that advances safety while ensuring that the societal benefits of the rule are greater than the costs. But history has proven that the 2003 rule, which was adopted a decade ago and has a decade of experience, has significantly reduced driver fatigue, and highway safety has been improved as a result. Where we part company with the agency is over the achievement of their stated goal of adopting a cost-beneficial regime in the 2011 regulation. We submit that the agency has inflated the benefits of the new rule by relying on outdated crash information, attributing significant health benefits to minuscule increases in sleep, which is not supported by the agency's record, and reversing its prior position on how much is adequate sleep without acknowledging that it has done so. When these errors are corrected, the rule no longer produces net benefits, and according to the agency's own stated preference for a cost-beneficial final rule, we believe this rule is not likely to have been enacted in the form it was once these errors are corrected. And that is why we're here this morning to urge you to vacate these particular provisions of the 2011 rule. There were four objectionable components to the changes that were made in 2011. First, we object to the 34-hour restart requiring a period of time between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. consecutively before it can be used again. We also object to the requirement that the restart be limited to once every 7 days or 168 hours. We object to the requirement that drivers take a 30-minute off-duty break, and we clarify that we have no objection to breaks from driving. We agree that they're beneficial for safety. It's the requirement that they be classified as off-duty that we object to. And we object to the narrowed regulatory exemption for short-haul drivers who've not been shown to have the same risk of fatigue as the long-haul drivers. We believe that that was not explained adequately by the agency in its final rule. And we think each of these changes is unsupported by the record. Turning first to the 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. period, the two periods of sleep that are required, or I put sleep in quotes because, of course, as everyone acknowledges in this case, nobody can require a truck driver to sleep. They can only make opportunities available for sleep. But there is a requirement in the new rule that the 34-hour restart include two periods of time between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. And this is supposed to be based on a study called the Van Dongen study. It's also called the University of Washington study. And this is relatively new data. It was not available in the previous rulemakings. We definitely agree that the agency is permitted to rely on new data. That's not the issue. The issue is that the data doesn't say what the agency says that it says. Rather, very clearly on the face of the study, the writers admit, acknowledge, and recognize that they were not evaluating the effect of the 34-hour restart on regular nighttime drivers who have a regular schedule that involves this 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. period of time. Rather, they evaluated the effect on drivers who were forced artificially into a daytime schedule. And when that change to their regular circadian rhythms was induced and forced, then, not surprisingly, they had a recovery period of reduced functionality the day they returned to their regular schedule. There's nothing surprising about that, but that does not support the application of that data to require a 1 to 5 hour stop work period that the 34-hour period of rest must include the 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. It simply didn't test the premises that would support that requirement. And that the loss of that 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. is actually quite significant. There's information, and particularly in the amicus brief, about the importance of that 5 a.m. delivery time period for those customers that are dependent on early delivery of perishable items. They referred to groceries and restaurants that want to take their deliveries at that early time before the stores open, before the restaurant opens, and that means twice a week the drivers who rely on that period are unable to serve that important part of the market. And that is a real cost. It's a real productivity loss. There's a suggestion that that would require payment of premiums for those time periods of delivery. And yet we submit that there is no evidence in the record to support those drivers who regularly work those times to have to take that added loss of productivity from their regular schedules. When we turn to the second concern that we've raised, which is limiting the restart to once every 7 days, the rationale offered for that was to reduce chronic fatigue and chronic health conditions. The agency again said that the decision was made on their conclusion that this would yield net benefits. But that is based on an assumption that is erroneous on several respects. It's based on an assumption that 13% of all large truck crashes are caused by fatigue. And they rely on data that predates the 2003 rule, so right there it's obsolete, it's out of date, and is not reasonable to form the basis of the conclusion that they've reached. But even in their own words, the study that they based it on, which is called the Large Truck Crash Causation Study, again relying on pre-2003 crash data, so obsolete right there, also, to the agency's own admission, oversamples the fatigue that was present, even given the obsolescence of the data, it overstated fatigue. So to rely on that both for its staleness and for its overstatement of fatigue to form the core building block of their benefit assessment is unreasonable. It's irrational. And they acknowledged that in 2008 at Joint Appendix 326. This becomes essential because if you don't agree that the 13% is a reasonable building block, and that number is something below 13%, we submit that it's somewhere in the range of 2 or at the highest level, we think it's 7. We don't think there's any support for 13. Then the denominator of the baseline of all of their benefits assessment drops significantly, and that is essential to their conclusion that the rule has net benefits. The other flaw in the reliance on the large truck causation crash causation study is that the 13% figure does not associate with causation. The authors of the study were very clear to say that the fatigue number that they identified of 13% was a so-called associated factor, not a cause of those crashes, and they were challenged by the authors of that study not to use those associated factors to attribute causation, and yet that's exactly what the agency did.
Ms. Jones, you make very persuasive points, but let me get up to a little higher level of generality, if we might. Whenever I hear arguments like these that seem to be powerful and persuasive policy points, I wonder, aren't these arguments that are better made before the agency? We're here on arbitrary and capricious review, right? And what's arbitrary and capricious about the agency deciding, you know, some of those delivery folks, it's gonna cost them some money, but there's a safety concern here, and we've just simply balanced it differently. That's not arbitrary and capricious. It may be a bad policy judgment, but we're not here to measure policy as whether it's good or bad. That's beyond our ken. We have a very light hand on this, right? And that's just to make certain that what they came up with is not irrational. It's not arbitrary and capricious.
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor, and that is the right summary of the right law. Your role is to review with a light touch to see whether the agency's conclusions match the data that they are relying on, and whether, under the words of State Farm, they have articulated a rational connection between the data they cite.
But I just always get hesitant whenever we're jumping into the middle of expert reports and you saying the expert report says one thing and the agency says the expert report says another thing. That's at least beyond my capacity to know which expert to believe.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. If we were asking you to choose between two competing interpretations of the data The agency will win that choice if both interpretations are reasonable. We agree with that. But where their interpretation is not reasonable, they don't enjoy the deference of this court.
Right.
And that's where we find fault with what they have done. We think it is unreasonable to rely on 2003 data, which has been rejected by the agency in the 2005 rule and in the 2008 rule.
Let me just seize on one point. You made the point about the 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock limitation on the 34-hour rule. Is that arbitrary that they chose 5 o'clock and it cost a number of people a significant burden on their livelihood, but the judgment was made that that would be safer? Is that arbitrary?
We believe it's arbitrary in the fact that it doesn't have a basis in the record, and it was not explained as having a basis in the record. There could be a rationale. It's not inherently arbitrary, Your Honor. It's arbitrary because it doesn't match the data that they claim supports it.
Thank you.
And it is a good segue into a discussion of the standard of review. We agree with Public Citizen's invocation of the Center for Auto Safety case, which is a D.C. Circuit case from nearly 30 years ago, Center for Auto Safety versus Peck, but we cite it for a purpose different than they do. That case says that there is a presumption against changes in current policy, and that the agency, if they're going to change current policy, must justify to you that they've done so on the basis of an adequate and reasonable review of the data before them. In this case, the current policy is working very well. That is the 2003 rule that has actually resulted in dramatic reductions in crashes and fatalities and injuries involving large trucks. That's been a success. And changes to that regulation that are included in the 2011 rule that are not based in a adequate showing of a safety need don't meet the standard of review that's articulated and don't meet the presumption in favor of current policy that is articulated in the Center for Auto Safety case. But it's also State Farm that teaches when an agency wants to cite uncertainty about the data, and to your point, Judge Griffith, there's a lot of uncertainty in this data. There's a lot of data floating around that has to be marshaled and reconciled and explained. But when the agency's dealing with conclusions that are uncertain, such as the Von Dongen study that says we don't think this is necessarily applicable to nighttime drivers who regularly drive at night, they cite to, well, it's uncertain, and so we have to just make some conclusions. And the problem with that is that the State Farm case tells agencies that they must justify when they don't engage in a search for further evidence. That's at State Farm at 52. They are obliged to search for further evidence. When you have data available to the agency that they cite for other purposes, the 2007 survey of truck driver hours that they rely on for another reason, which gave them access to the compliance reviews of almost 1,000 truck drivers, a sample that they've used for other purposes in this case, and yet they don't use that same data to draw conclusions about how many drivers are really using that 34-hour restart to maximize their hours. The study says it's only 8%, and it doesn't say that it's the same 8% week in and week out. And if you don't have that intensity of the same drivers always taking advantage of the maximum amount of minimizing the amount of off time so that they can start their clock as quickly as possible, the assumption they make in order to reach the health benefits is that it's the same drivers week in and week out. There's no basis in the record to assume that. And if you don't assume that, and you instead assume the more reasonable that occasionally driver number one will do it, next week it might be driver number two who does it, next week it might be driver number three who does it, you can't simply fall back on uncertainty. State Farm says, you're the agency. You have to go find out. You've had 10 years to work on this. Why don't you know? Why are we still in the realm of uncertain with all this data as to whether those drivers really are intensely concentrating the maximum use of that restart provision? It's not fair to say we don't know. They have the data to find out, and State Farm says they have to do so.
But you're not You're not arguing that they can't extrapolate from a small sample, for instance?
No, of course not, Your Honor, and I recognize they have to do that. We're always going to be dealing with small samples that have to reflect. We're never going to have a census of every truck driver. We respect that, and we respect the agency's authority and responsibility to do that. But they have to do it on, they have to explain that they're doing it, and it has to be rational. And it's not enough under State Farm to simply say, well, we're uncertain, when they have in their possession and capacity to know better data. They have to follow the data, and that's what State Farm teaches. Which leads to the concern that we have about the reliance on the sleep study, the study that is a core of their health benefits, absent which the rule is not cost beneficial. I don't think there's any dispute about that. If the health benefits go away, the rule is a net cost. Those health benefits are derived on an assumption that adding a few minutes of sleep a night to truck drivers is going to yield hundreds of millions of dollars of health benefits, and that's simply not rational. The study it's based on studied sleep in one-hour increments. The authors started at the low end at 5 hours of sleep and below. They then measured 6, 7, 8, 9, and above. And the health benefits, or I should say disbenefits, the health risks, begin at 5 hours of sleep and below. And we have a truck driver population that by the agency's own numbers, the low end is 6.28 hours of sleep, which is in the healthy range. So adding sleep to drivers already in the healthy range is not going to yield health benefits. Yet they are extrapolating from a sleep study that is based on improvements measured in hour-long increments, and we don't even dispute the idea that they might swing a half hour. It might be 5.5 to 6.5. That still doesn't get you into the realm that they have taken it, which has no basis in the record, and that is to assume that 2 more minutes, 1 more minute, a few more seconds of sleep per night is going to have any health benefits whatsoever. And that is not explained, other than to say, well, it's a U-shaped curve, so we're going to just plot, we're going to keep going along the U. But that's not reasonable. That's not what the study says. And one of the study's principal co-authors, Dr. Cappuccio, said so in record comments. The other author, Dr. Ferry, who's comments the agency likes to cite, simply generally said that the study looked pretty good. But her co-author said there is no scientific basis to do what the agency did, and that is to take a study that's driven by one-hour increments, subdivide it into 60-second increments, and apply benefits down at that micro level. The science just simply doesn't support that. And without that, the agency doesn't have a beneficial rule. And by their own statement, it's not a rule that they would have adopted. I have just a couple of minutes left. I'd like to turn briefly to the breaks, to the requirement to take 30 minutes of off-duty break is based entirely on a study that we call the Blanco study. The agency calls the Blanco study. Dr. Blanco studied breaks of and categorized them in 4 different types of breaks and concluded that so-called off-duty breaks were the most beneficial. The agency seized on that and decided to require breaks to be off-duty. We agree that driving more than 8 hours is a bad idea without a break, and we agree that there are benefits to taking breaks, and we have no quarrel with a required break. The quarrel we have is the requirement to characterize that break as off-duty, as opposed to permitting a mixed time where some duty and some off-duty time can be mixed. Dr. Blanco's study does not say that the off-duty break required by the agency was the most beneficial. It said the off-duty break of mowing the lawn and doing housework, leisure time, that's what she characterized as off-duty. And that's not going to be the truck driver's breaks. They're not going home for those 30 minutes and mowing the lawn. They're going to be at the side of the road or at a truck stop, or they're in their berth, or they're eating, or they're resting. They are not going home. So the fourth category of break that she said was the most beneficial isn't in play. And when you look at the other 3 types of breaks,
the list was any consecutive duration of off-duty activity, and it includes rest, eat, light housework, heavy housework, light leisure activity, heavy leisure activity, driving another vehicle, and other. Why doesn't that include breaks when they're not at home? Rest, eat.
It includes those, Your Honor, but so do the other 3 types, the other 2 types of breaks that would be counted as off-duty by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. And our point is that to the extent that her fourth category had those playing sports and mowing the lawn, those aren't going to happen on these breaks. They might be coded as Type 4, but they are equally likely to be coded as types 1 or 3, and those are statistically indistinguishable from that type 4 break. According to her own estimates, they don't have a sufficient statistical validity to attribute a difference. They are statistically indistinguishable at Joint Appendix 775 and 776. And so types 1, 3, and 4 have the same statistical power, and our point is that they should equally be available. If you're going to rely on this study says types 1, 3, and 4 are statistically the same in terms of yielding benefits, and we're fine with that. We're not suggesting type 2, which is the working during the break. We're suggesting types 1, 3, and 4 are statistically indistinguishable from each other by the agency's own study. Plus, these are self-coded, Your Honor, so that
51% is statistically indistinguishable from 33%, is that your
yes, Your Honor, that's what she says in her study, that those are such small numbers that they are statistically indistinguishable from one another.
Is there a mistake on page 47 of your brief? I'm looking at it now. In the first full paragraph, next to last line?
Yes, Your Honor, that was corrected in our reply brief. It is an error. It's a typographical error. The reply brief corrected that, and we apologize. And then the last point, I see my time has expired. I will bring up my last point on my rebuttal if I have the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Scott Nelson, representing petitioners Public Citizen Dana Logan et al., and I would like to, if I may, reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In this case, we're coming at this from the opposite side of ATA. The problem here fundamentally is that the agency acted irrationally by failing to fulfill its statutory duties to improve safety, prevent impairment of worker health, and make safety its highest priority when it substantially, once again, increased allowable per shift and weekly driving time by failing to restore the 10-hour per shift driving limit that had been in effect prior to 2003, and by continuing to allow a restart that results in significantly higher weekly working hours for truck drivers than were permitted at the time when Congress instructed the agency to act to improve worker safety and health.
Mr. Nelson, before you get into the merits of this, I want to ask you a question about standing.
Sure.
And my question is, I'm assuming that in part you argue that you have standing because you represent it's Logan.
Yes, that's right.
The independent drug. But my understanding is that she waived her objection to the once a week limit. Right.
Well, so first, I don't think that's quite an accurate characterization. What she said was that she supported limiting the restart compared to what was in effect. She didn't say that she ever approved of using the restart to extend working hours. But second, there's a difference between standing and waiver. In order to have standing to object, you have to have an injury in fact. There's no requirement of issue exhaustion in order to seek judicial review under this statute. So if the issue was before the agency, it doesn't matter whether the person who has standing was the one who raised it. And in this case, the agency acknowledged that the organizational petitioners had maintained their position that the restart was never justified and that the proper baseline for comparison should be the pre-2000 rules with no restart, as compared to which the agency's proposal significantly extended working hours. The agency just said, we're not going to go back and revisit that without ever making any kind of finding that the restart provision itself had net benefits compared to the pre-2003 regime. At the same time, I think what's really significant is the difference between what the agency has found this time on its further review of the evidence before it and what it was willing to acknowledge on previous occasions. The agency now acknowledges that the 11th hour of driving contains significantly higher safety risks, and the agency acknowledges that eliminating that 11th hour would have significant safety benefits. That's contrary to the implausible position it maintained before, and implausible was this court's description of it, that going from 10 to 11 hours would have no negative safety impact. And second, the agency now also acknowledges on the restart provision that really the only function that the restart has is to allow significant increases in weekly working hours, which can also translate into significant increases in driving hours.
Now, in your comments, didn't you support the limitations on the restart?
Our comments said that we oppose the use of a restart. They then went on to say, if you're going to have a restart, this is an improvement. And we would support this whole package, and we wouldn't challenge it, contingent on the agency acting to reduce the acute fatigue that's attributable to the 11-hour daily driving limit and adopting.
That was a package deal. You said go to 10 and we'll take a pass on restart with these limitations.
In part, there was another part of the package that they didn't make good on either, and that is the one-week limit on taking the restart for drivers who are on 8-day, 70-hour schedules, and that's really the majority of the long-haul drivers because you can only be on a 7-day, 60-hour schedule if your carrier operates only 6 days a week. So most of the truckers out there on the roads are on these 8-day, 70-hour schedules. And the way the math works out is you can be in there maximizing either your working hours or driving hours, and that one-week limit on taking the restart doesn't end up really having much of an effect on you at all. You can week after week work or drive somewhere around 83 hours in 8 days, or if you look at it as 7 days, it's 70 hours. But either way, it's a significant increase from the old rule, which was 70 hours in 7 days. And the agency also recognizes now what it didn't recognize before, which is that drivers who work those lengthy hours have cumulative sleep deficits that have significant impacts on their health. And that's why the agency finds that even limiting the restart to the limited extent that it limited it had significant health benefits for drivers.
My problem is that the agency record, talking now about Logan, and then I want to get to your position, the record in the agency, what she said to the agency, seems to contradict what she's now saying in her affidavit to this court. Before the agency, she said, I like the restart provision, and I have no problem with it, and I use it myself, and so on. And then, so if you stop there, if you stop the moving picture right there, you would have to say that she cannot then come into court and oppose it after telling the agency she liked it. Here she's saying, after using a 34-hour restart, I feel fatigued the following week. I believe the restart allows an amount of driving that's unsafe. And it seems to me those two statements can't stand together.
I think if you look at the statements that she made when she was in the agency discussion section, and that's at page 365 of the joint appendix.
Oh, I did look at that. Can you tell me what the dates are? The letter at JA 607 is the one I referred to. I also like the one time a week restart. In all my years on the road, I've never used it more than once a week. However, I think it's a good idea. What is the date of that letter? There's no date on it.
Your Honor, I don't have the date available. I can.
Well, the reason I'm asking is whether that was before or after the comments that she made orally.
My understanding would be that the comment session came after, but I would have to check on that, and I can supply the court with that information. I don't think that it's in the joint appendix, unfortunately.
Well, there's no date there. I noticed in the index it says March, I think, I'm not sure.
In any event, Your Honor, if I can refer, because I can't answer the date question as I'm standing here, unfortunately. But I think if you look at what she's saying in her comments to the agency, there are times when a driver will take a 34-hour break and use that to restart their clock, but they don't really need to use it to restart the clock because they're not running up against the limits. And that's the kind of situation she's talking about when she says, you know, in those cases, the restart is just fine. But she says, you know, when I've been driving a lot, and I then take the restart of 34 hours and then have to go back on after that 34 hours is ended, and I would otherwise have been up against the limit. She says, that's when I haven't had enough time to recover, I'm still fatigued and I haven't had a sufficient break. So I think her position there is consistent. But in any event, I don't think that when the issue was before the agency, there's law to support the idea that a person is subject to an issue exhaustion bar for having failed to raise it personally.
Well, let's get to your situation. I've read the comment that you put in, your client put in, and I don't see a statement there that the agency should eliminate the restart. What I do see are statements that petitioners are opposed to the use of a restart but acknowledge the proposed rule will improve safety, et cetera, and then petitioners support the proposal for the proposal is contingent on the restoration of the 10-hour limit, et cetera. Petitioners also support proposed modifications and so on and so forth. Now, if I'm an agency administrator and I'm reading this, I'm not reading that paragraph to say, we, public citizen, hereby urge you, the agency, to eliminate the restart provision. What I'm seeing is we support the restart with the following modifications.
Judge Randolph, I mean, with due respect, I think first that the agency administrator actually interpreted it properly and consistent with the interpretation that we advocate, that our position was they had never justified the use of the restart and they had an obligation to in comparison with the 2003 rules, and they simply rejected that position without a sufficient explanation.
And so you say that the argument about what the baseline should be is the equivalent of an argument that there should be no restart provision?
Well, if you just said baseline by itself, it might not be sufficiently explanatory. But you know, what the agency actually said was, advocates, in contrast, stated that the 11th hour of driving and the 34-hour restart had never been adequately supported by evidence. They stated that unless the agency can demonstrate that the 2003 changes would improve safety and not adversely affect driver health, the 2003 provisions cannot stand. The baseline for the rulemaking in their argument should be the pre-2003 10-hour driving limit and no restart.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
And I think, you know, in the context where as the advocates said in their comments, they have consistently opposed the use of the 34-hour restart, and they do oppose it, and they went on to explain why they opposed it, and this is at JA 648, that the 35-hour does not allow sufficient time for recovery. I think that the agency properly understood that any support that was being offered for a use of a restart at all was contingent on an overall compromise, and that absent that compromise, we were not abandoning our position. I'd like to talk a little bit, though, in my remaining time about the 10 and 11 hours, in part because, you know, I think everybody agrees that position was thoroughly maintained throughout. And the agency's explanation there for its choice is I think, to go back to Judge Griffith's question from the earlier part of the argument, is just irrational. It's not a question of contesting their expert judgment. They actually found that on various sets of assumptions, the different 10-hour and 11-hour rules would have different sets of net benefits. And then what they said was, because the 11-hour options calculated net benefits, quote, appear likely to be somewhat higher than the net benefits of the 10-hour option, under some assumptions about baseline conditions, they chose the 11-hour. But what they failed to do was draw the necessary step that's required to make that conclusion rational, which is to make a finding about whether those assumptions under which the 11-hour option had, quote, higher net benefits were good assumptions. And if you look at all of their actual, you know, findings elsewhere in the rulemaking record, you find that they don't actually endorse the assumptions under which the 11 hours appeared to have higher net benefits. Their position, for example, on the amount of sleep that the high-intensity drivers were getting, there were three possibilities under which they calculated benefits: low sleep, medium sleep, high sleep. They maintained that the evidence was quite clear that these drivers were actually getting low sleep. So the medium sleep and high sleep, the benefits under those assumptions can't really fit into the mix. They're unreasonable assumptions. Similarly, the agency preferred the 13% or higher figure for fatigue-related accidents. So you can really, in assessing net benefits, you really need to kind of drop off the 7% figure, because the agency itself said there's no actual support for that. If you just look at their own best assumptions, the low sleep and 13% fatigue-related accident figures, what you find are that the net benefits of 10 hours versus 11 hours, 10 hours comes out higher by, I think, something like $30 million annually under a 3% discount rate. 11 hours comes out $40 million higher under a 7% discount rate. The agency never explains why it would prefer one of those discount rates to the other, which is an obligation this court has imposed on agencies using discount rates, 25 years ago. And in any event, even if you let them say we weigh those equally, under a statute where their obligation is actually to make safety the highest priority, making a marginal difference in net benefits under one discount rate the dispositive consideration just doesn't fit with that duty to make safety the highest priority.
If that's the criteria, why not go to 9-hour? That's even
safer. I mean, to begin with, we would love a 9-hour, but, yeah, you know, we're not going to get
it. How about 8? How about 7?
Well, we never have advocated, I think, for below 8. The agency has two obligations. It has an obligation to consider cost, and it has an obligation to make safety the highest priority. Now, we think that what that has to be read as meaning is that they need to put a thumb on the scale in favor of safety. If costs are grossly disproportionate, at some point they can start considering cost to be the dispositive factor.
And you've been able to identify a principal distinction between 10 and 9?
Well, they If you look at the costs that they attributed to 9, they actually did attribute much higher costs and significantly lower net benefits. So, you know, if I had to stand here and litigate that, I would feel not very confident in my likelihood of succeeding. But when they, under their own preferred assumptions, are basically saying it's a wash and it depends on whether you the 10-hour rule is better unless you make the assumption that people discount their future health and safety at a 7% discount rate, which is, you know, the rate of return that large companies may get on their investment, and not a rate of return that a truck driver gets on anything. But even if you take their preferred higher discount rate, it's only a $10 million difference, and they've acknowledged that the safer rules have unquantifiable health and safety benefits in addition to the ones that they've monetized. Under those circumstances, it's just not rational to prefer 11 hours to 10. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Jonathan Levy with the United States Department of Justice, representing the FMCSA. The extensive record on review here shows an expert agency addressing a host of extremely complex and challenging questions. It did so in full compliance with the APA and at all times acted rationally. I think to respond to some of the arguments that were made previously, the phrase "no basis in the record" was repeated numerous times earlier in this argument, and I think dramatically misused. What petitioners have said is, we don't agree with the agency's interpretation of the data. We don't like certain data sets that the agency has used, and we don't like certain studies that the agency has relied upon, and we don't like the conclusions that they have drawn, that the agency has drawn from those studies. That is not, with respect, a statement that there is no basis in the record. That is simply a disagreement, usually on very technical and scientific terms, about what the agency has done with the data. Now, if you look carefully at all these arguments, the agency has, in fact, performed in the preferred and most accurate way, and I'm happy to go into the details of all that. But I think as a big picture point, the main point is that these are largely simple scientific disputes. For example, one of these disputes seems to if not turn on, at least involve a dispute between the lead author of a study and a secondary author of that same study as to the preferred method of interpreting the data produced by that study. I don't think that it is this court's duty with respect to weigh in on that kind of dispute. The question is, did the agency, in following the course that it did for the scientific reasons that it did, and a course that it turns out was supported by the lead author of the study, did it act rationally? And it seems to me that the answer to that question is that it clearly did. Obviously, the agency's actions here are challenged from both sides, and that's one of the things that makes this interesting, and it's one of the things that I think shows the scientific nature of what's going on here. There are several specific statistics or predictions or estimates that the agency made that are being attacked as arbitrary and capricious from both sides. And so, for example, one of the estimates that has come up so far is the 13% fatigue-related crash estimate. But both sets of petitioners say that that number is irrational. The industry petitioners say it's irrational because the real number is somewhere between 2 and 3%. And public citizen petitioners say that number is irrational because the correct number that had to be used was between 30 and 40%. Now, we can talk about the scientific specifics of this, but that's the context in which the agency's actions are being attacked here. And I think if you go line by line and look carefully at what the agency did, the agency acted very carefully, very rationally, and fully scientifically. The agency had to balance a number of interests here: safety interests, health interests, and economic interests. The agency did take these concerns to heart, particularly with respect to safety, which is the agency's highest interest. The new rule has a number of important safety innovations, including the introduction for the first time of the brake requirement, and the limitations that it introduces on the use of the weekly restart provision. At the same time, as was just recently discussed, the agency decided not to have a 10-hour shift requirement and instead to have a 11-hour shift limit. And it was very clear that it did so based on the understanding that although 10 hours per shift might have a small safety benefit, that was overwhelmed by the high economic cost of such an option. So the record shows a consideration of the relevant factors, a weighing of the relevant factors, the exercise of the agency's discretion in weighing those factors, and there is no basis for reversal there.
The agency is taken to task by Public Citizen, at least, for stating that in order to change from 11 hours, which was then in effect, to 10 hours, it needed compelling scientific evidence and a definitive demonstration. That appears to be a standard that the agency adopted, but I don't see your brief supporting that.
The brief does not support that standard because that standard is incorrect. And there is one or possibly two statements that appear in the record, which is a very lengthy record, that do in fact appear to adopt that incorrect standard. However,
let me ask you something.
Yes.
I don't understand why it's incorrect. If an agency announces that we're not going to change, now one can argue about what the baseline is, but assuming that the baseline is the regime in effect, an agency announces we're not going to change the existing system unless we have compelling scientific evidence to indicate that a change is needed. I don't know why an agency can't adopt that standard.
I think the word compelling is simply too strong. I don't know where.
Where does the law come from that says that's too strong for an agency?
The agency has discretion. The agency is given discretion by Congress, and it, in the government's view, could act on the basis. Has the authority and the discretion to act on the basis of evidence that some might not call compelling.
That's certain, but that's the standard for judicial review. In other words, a court would look at this and say, well, if they only had a reasonable basis, they don't need compelling evidence.
Correct.
That is fine, but what I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about internally. I don't see why an agency could not have a standard that says we're not going to change the existing rules unless there's compelling scientific evidence. What's wrong with that?
I think you are correct, Your Honor, but I don't think that that's what the agency did here. I think there is that one comment, that one use of that language. But again, this is a very lengthy statement, and if you look at it as a whole, what the agency did was weigh the factors. It clearly concluded that there was a small, and I want to be clear because that's what the agency said, safety benefit to having the 10 hours, but that there was a significant economic cost to going to 10 hours. So, for example, on page 1065 of the joint appendix.
Right. They say the cost would be high to change it.
Well, no, there are additional statements that I would like to point out to Your Honor. The agency said, quote, allowing only 10 hours of driving would increase costs substantially without a commensurate increase in benefits. That's the basis for the decision. That's one articulation of it. On page 1063, the agency said that the 11-hour limit has substantially higher net benefits than the 10-hour limit in most cases. It acknowledged the reality that a 10-hour limit might save more lives and prevent more crashes, but at higher cost. And what the record shows as a whole is that there was a balancing here, as there always is, and as there would be if the agency, well, as there was, frankly, when the agency considered, which it did, a 9-hour rule. And it seems that everyone in this room appears to agree that the 9-hour option is sort of off the table, because the analysis showed that the cost was extreme and that the benefits were minimal, even though there were benefits. And that is the exact same balancing that the agency engaged in when it decided on 11 hours per shift instead of 10 hours per shift. It wasn't as extreme. The numbers weren't as extreme, but the balancing was exactly the same.
I thought Mr. Nelson said there was only $10 million between those two alternatives. Is he wrong about that?
He is wrong about that. The agency did not and could not come up with a single number for the overall cost benefit, because there are extreme uncertainties here that the agency had to deal with. And this court has been clear that the agency, when faced with uncertainty, isn't supposed to pretend the uncertainty doesn't exist. So I would turn your attention to Joint Appendix page 835, which has the executive summary tables of the RIA. And these are the results, if you will, of the cost-benefit analysis under different scenarios. And I apologize for the complexity of this, but it's simply a very complex problem that the agency was dealing with. And so it addressed 18 different scenarios. And it did so for the three different options, which are essentially the, unfortunately, they're out of order, the 10-hour, the 11-hour, and the 9-hour options, all as compared to the current rule then in effect. And so if you want to know what the number is, you're sort of comparing a table. And when my understanding of what opposing counsel said is that they disagree with some of those 18 scenarios. They think that the agency should have eliminated some of them. And if you eliminate all of the scenarios that Public Citizen wants eliminated, then you get this $10 million difference. But if you look at the table, depending on which scenario, and if you average them out, the difference is much, much greater than that. The agency weighed cost, which it's required to do. It considered health, and it looked at safety. At the end of the day, in choosing between 10 hours and 11 hours, you're simply exercising judgment as an executive agency empowered by Congress to do so and with the expertise to do so. The idea of having a thumb on the scale is just very difficult to implement, and for a court to try to figure out what does it mean, the thumb on the scale, how many millions of dollars, tens of million dollars, or hundreds of million dollars does a thumb on the scale equal? I would submit that is not a question really properly for a court. That's a question properly for the agency. Congress asked the agency to look into this. Congress asked the agency to weigh apples and oranges, right? When you're weighing safety on one hand versus cost on the other hand, it's not something that is in any way subject to any kind of mathematical precision or certainty. It inherently requires the exercise of discretion and expert judgment, and that is exactly what occurred here. The other issue that Public Citizen has raised is the question of the restart, and I'd like to turn to that issue, unless there are other questions from the panel. When it comes to the restart, the most obvious point is that Public Citizen waived this in its comments, which supported the notice of proposed rulemaking. The notice of proposed rulemaking has a restart provision in it, and Public Citizen's comments repeatedly said that they endorsed the proposals of the notice of proposed rulemaking. That, of course, put the agency on notice that Public Citizen supported a restart provision, And it now comes to the court and says the opposite. It says, we don't want it, we never wanted it. And that's just not what their comments said. That's not how any agency reasonably reading the comments could possibly interpret them. And in fact, even earlier in 2010, Public Citizen submitted a proposal in a comment to the agency that affirmatively included a restart provision. It happens to be a 48-hour restart provision. So to the extent that there's any lack of clarity in the comments themselves, which I don't think there are, you have to look at the history here because this has been going on for a long time. In 2005, when Public Citizen did in fact oppose the restart, they told the agency that in no uncertain terms. They said, one of the most harmful aspects of the NPRM, this is the 2005 NPRM, is the 34-hour restart provision. Public Citizen strongly urges that it be eliminated. That's clear. The agency understood what that meant. In 2010, Public Citizen proposed a restart provision for the hours of service rules. And in 2000...
In the joint appendix?
The 2010? Yes, it is. Let me just... I believe that's at page 383, Your Honor. It's a little bit difficult to read because what they and I believe others jointly submitted is just a single-page chart that shows what they wanted in an hours of service rule, and it includes a 48-hour restart provision. So the agency was, of course, aware of that. And then in 2011, when Public Citizen said, we support the notice of proposed rulemaking and the changes to the baseline that are included in that notice, the agency understood that to mean exactly what it said, which was that Public Citizen was now supporting the restart. And in fact, the comments contain, you know, lavish praise on the restart as limited and talk about how it performs its task admirably and it's a good innovation. It calls it a reasonable approach to the issue. So obviously that is support for a restart, and the idea that you can read that comment and somehow read between the lines and infer that what Public Citizen really meant was we don't want any restart at all doesn't make any sense. And when in the rule the agency discussed what Public Citizen had said, there are several references to the fact that Public Citizen supported the restart provision. There is also a reference to the fact that Public Citizen viewed the baseline as the pre-2003 rule. And what that means is that Public Citizen viewed the notice of proposed rulemaking as proposing changes to that baseline. But they then said, instead of saying what they could have said, which is, we want to go back to the baseline, we prefer the regime under which there was no restart. They could have said that, but they didn't say that. They said, we understand that the notice of proposed rulemaking proposes changes to the baseline. We endorse them. And of course, one of those changes, one of the primary changes, was the restart provision. So there is a clear waiver there, and Public Citizen should not be heard now to complain that the regulations include a restart provision. Unless there are further questions about Public Citizen's contentions, I can now turn to ATA's.
What do you do with the Logan affidavit?
Well,
I take it it's the two drivers that Public Citizen relies upon to have standing, at least with respect to the restart in the 11-hour, and one of them doesn't really deal with it, and the other seems to contradict what she said to the agency.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I don't know what the timing is of the different statements, although obviously the declaration submitted with the briefs post-date the comments. But there is something unsettling about the idea that this individual also came before the agency and affirmatively supported the restart. And I have to say I disagree with Public Citizen's interpretation of her statements in the comments. Her comments do not compare a limited restart and an unlimited restart. Her comments don't limit don't say, I'm talking about the restart only when it's used in certain circumstances and not others. Her comments are unequivocal. She supports the restart. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether she is entitled to change her opinion between the point in time at which she was submitting a comment to the agency and the point in time in which she is trying to support Public Citizen's standing. And I also don't,
One way of framing it up is that given her statement to the agency, she's not a party aggrieved.
Well, she isn't a party aggrieved. I think that is correct. I want to point out that it is not the government's view that there are no parties aggrieved, that no one has standing here. We don't think that's the case. We needed to point out the standing issue to this court because it's a jurisdictional issue, and we feel we have an obligation to do so. And we don't know why Public Citizen didn't come forward with another individual or with a declaration here that provides more clarity than the one that they have provided. Turning to ATA's challenges, I can certainly go through the list of the scientific disputes and go one by one about which data set is better, which statistics is better, which prediction makes more sense. Before I do that, I feel obliged to just say generally that these are the kinds of decisions that agencies make all the time, and that courts rightly don't allow parties to sort of come in and say, we have an expert who says you're wrong. We have a study that gives a different number. You can't do that. What you need to do is show that the agency acted unreasonably. And that simply hasn't happened here. The agency in each case, and generally very exhaustively, looked at the data available, looked at the studies available, discussed why it was taking the specific decision that it was, and made entirely reasonable and rational choices. The 13% figure comes from the large truck crash causation study, which listed 13% of the accidents as having fatigue present. The only real objection to that I heard earlier today was that the data is somewhat old, which is true. The data is old. But of course, sometimes, as this court has recognized, older data is the best data, and that's what the agency determined here. The large truck crash causation study is the largest and most comprehensive and in many ways arguably the most accurate study of its kind done. The data at issue here, I believe, involved 78,000 crashes. Now, one of the studies that ATA relies on for its 2.2% rate involved a study of, I believe, 47 crashes. It is entirely reasonable for the agency to conclude that a larger, much, much larger, and more comprehensive study it might be more accurate in this area than a very, very much smaller study, even if that very much smaller study might be more recent. There are a host of similar explanations as to why the agency chose the data that it did. There is also a question that I believe was raised earlier about, you can't tell whether the fatigue, the 13% fatigue, caused the accident. And the answer is that is true. You can't tell for certain. You can never tell for certain what causes an accident. But the agency, in the exercise of its expertise, believes that in general it is a fair assumption that where fatigue is found to be present, because it is underreported, that where it is found to be present, it can be assumed to be an important factor in the crash. It's worth noting that the same study found that 7% of the crashes were caused by a truck driver actually falling asleep. And I think it's obvious that that is an absolute minimum on the percentage of crashes caused by fatigue, and that the number can be assumed to be significantly higher. But that number was 7% found of the drivers actually falling asleep. So the 13% figure is entirely reasonable. On the health effects issue, as I understand it, the criticism of the agency there is that there is a U-shaped curve, and it is formed by data points that were collected at hour-long intervals, and it is somehow inappropriate based on that data to draw a curve and then use the curve that you get to assess mortality at the different sleep levels. I have to say that I don't really understand that criticism. That's what scientists do all the time. They take data points, they fit a curve to those data points, and then they assume that the curve reflects the relationship between the two sets of data. Again, ATA was able to point out that one of the secondary co-authors of the study seem to think that the agency shouldn't be interpreting the data that way. The primary study author of the study said that the agency had acted responsibly and reasonably in interpreting the data. And the question, you know, sort of is, should the court weigh in on this scientific dispute? And can the court look at this scientific dispute and determine that in doing what it did, the agency acted unreasonably? I don't think there's any way of reading the record and concluding that the agency acted unreasonably. I'm not sure that any of ATA's other claims here require a specific response. Obviously, our brief is more comprehensive in discussing all these issues, but I'm happy to respond to any individual questions that the court may have.
Can I ask you about the 30-minute break for
yes.
short-haul drivers?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it appears, and maybe you have a different view of this, that the notice of proposed rulemaking didn't seem like it was going there.
Well, what I don't think that's correct, respectfully, Your Honor. What the notice of proposed rulemaking said was two things that you have to put together in order to get you there. So the first thing that the notice of proposed rulemaking said was that the agency was considering having the hours of service rules generally apply to short-haul drivers. The status quo was that the hours of service rules generally did not apply.
What's a short-haul driver?
I believe the definition, it has to do with the distance from a home base sort of thing, and I believe it's either 50 miles or 100 miles. So you're generally talking about local delivery types of drivers as opposed to long-haul drivers, drivers who are driving across the country and that sort of thing. So what the notice of proposed rulemaking said is two things. One is we are considering, we are not proposing, but we are considering making the hours of service rules generally applicable to this class, the short-haul drivers. And then separately, the notice of proposed rulemaking, of course, proposed adding to the hours of service rules a break requirement, which it ultimately has done. So if you put those two things together, if the hours of service rule is going to be changed to include a break requirement, and if it's also going to be changed to encompass short-haul drivers, then that means there is a possibility that short-haul drivers will be subject to a break requirement. And that is why it was foreseeable, understandable, and reasonable, predictable, if you will, that the agency would apply this rule.
Did the agency get any comments?
Yes.
About the applying the break rule to short-haul drivers?
Yes, it did. Joint appendix pages, Joint appendix pages 336, 563 to 567, and 742. And not only that, but ATA in its reply brief acknowledges that in fact these comments occurred. As far as I can tell, what ATA appears to say is that this was an all-or-nothing package, and somehow the reason there are those comments is because the short-haul drivers understood that as part of an all-or-nothing package, they could be made subject to the brake requirement. But there's nothing to support this all-or-nothing theory, and in fact, this court's case law is very clear that when a rule is proposed or a set of regulations, that it is fully predictable, and this should be obvious, it is fully predictable that the agency might adopt less than all of the proposed rules. And that is exactly what happened here. The agency did not decide to make all of the hours of service rules applicable to short-haul drivers. It chose a subset, specifically the brake requirement. And that is entirely predictable, as this court has repeatedly held. Therefore, there is no procedural flaw with imposing that requirement. I think the fact that individual short-haul truckers commented on their concerns about that, the brake, specifically about the brake requirement being imposed upon them, you know, clearly demonstrates that this was understood and not procedurally flawed. If there are no further questions from the panel, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Jones? I'm not sure. Does she have any time left? No. Okay. I don't think you have any time left, but we will give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. I want to return to the point that we left when I sat down, which is the statistical significance in the study regarding the four types of brakes. And to Judge Randolph's question, the answer is on Joint Appendix 788, immediately above Table 39. It says the output of this model is shown on Table 39 and suggests none of the brake types have a significant impact, and that's referring to statistical significance, as the p-values for each brake type are greater than 0.05. And so for that, our point here is that all four are statistically indistinguishable. To the second point that we just heard from Mr. Levy about asking you to choose between the competing views of the two authors of the sleep study, we're not asking you to do that. We understand that would not be appropriate. Rather, we're asking you to look at what Dr. Ferry herself said in her comment to the agency that otherwise generally supported their methodology. At Joint Appendix 634, she said that the U-shaped curve means, and this is a quote, that changing average sleep makes very little difference for individuals. We agree with that, and that is what we're asking you to consider in deciding whether it was rational to attribute these very small changes in a matter of minutes. As to whether the large truck crash causation study is the best data, I would point you to Joint Appendix 326, which was the 2008 final rule, in which the agency itself said that that study tends to overstate, not understate, the importance of fatigue. So how they could change their mind a few years later and now reach back to 2003 to rely on that is not explained in the record. And then finally, to the point of the 7% falling asleep, which is from that large truck causation study, that is actually not an accurate representation of the data. The crash study involved 141,000 trucks. That's found on Joint Appendix 419. The 78,000 is a subset in which the truck was assigned the principal cause, and it is 7% of that number is really 3% of the total number of crashes in the study. And I thank you for the time.
Right. Thank you very much. Mr. Nelson, I think you may have had a minute left, so we'll give you two.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with a clarification in answer to Judge Randolph's question. It looks to me as if the comment was submitted in March 2011, and that's based on the comment period when things like that were received in the agency record. The listening session was in 2010, I believe. But I think if you look at all of her statements together, they consistently say that even though she doesn't use the restart more than once a week, she feels fatigued when she uses it, and the result is to increase her weekly driving hours. That's consistent with what she said in the listening session. So I think she is a person aggrieved. As to public citizens' position, you know, the government says that you could look at our comments and think we supported the restart. The very first page says we oppose a restart, and we go on to explain why it doesn't allow sufficient time to for recovery. Our earlier proposal that was alluded to of a restart ourselves was for a 48-hour restart, which is an entirely different type of restart. It doesn't carry with it the same kinds of consequences for dramatic increases in daily and weekly, weekly working and driving hours. As to the 10 versus 11 hours, we're not asking the court to adopt our preferred places on this matrix of 18 different assumptions. We're saying that the agency failed to explain why it treated all of them equally and averaged them all together when its own statements indicate that the only ones that are conceivably reasonable are the low sleep assumption and the 13% or higher figure for fatigue-caused accidents. And if you look at those, that reduces it from four positions in the or 18 matrix positions to four. The 10-hour option actually comes out better. And even if you look at just the 13%, which is their preferred figure on causal of accidents, it's basically a wash. And in that circumstance, for the agency to say we can't change it without compelling demonstration, when their own evidence indicates that the net benefits of a change are at least comparable or as great as the 11-hour rule, is irrational. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Case will be submitted.